Hello and welcome to the Heritage Langham podcast number 7. I'm Heather Payton. This month we're doing something quite different. You join me on a cross-channel ferry heading for Dunkirk and Flanders to find out more about Langham's Flemish founders at first hand. Over the next few days, we'll be hearing about the Flemish traveller who visited Haverford West in the second half of the 16th century and found the Flemish language still alive there after 400 years. We'll be hearing about the lives of the men and women who left one coast to make their lives on another many hundreds of miles west. And we'll be meeting the DNA detectives who will be looking for clues that Flemish genes survive in Pembrokeshire. But first, we're off to Antwerp to meet a man who can clear up once and for all if the Flemish really were driven from their homes by a 12th century flood. Well, here we are in Antwerp, and the man who knows all about coastal flooding in medieval times is Professor Tim Soons of the university here. Tim, we've had lots of confusing accounts of why the Flemish people came to Pembrokeshire. How feasible is it that they left because of a huge flood in the 1100s?
It certainly is feasible. We have an increasing number of reports on floods, and some of them, like the one of 1134, are considered to have been major floods causing quite a lot of damage in a rather wide region in the north of Flanders and on the islands of what is today Zeeland. But of course we have to imagine that it's not just about one big apocalyptic flood which causes a sort of major disaster and makes survivors leave the area. We also have to see this as a process of structural transformation of this landscape, this very dynamic landscape of these coastal areas, which is constantly evolving, but in particular in these 11th and 12th century is rapidly transformed by man.
At the time of the big floods, the 1134 one that you mentioned, for example, what effect would that have had on people? What would they have done?
I can imagine that, of course, the immediate relief and the immediate efforts to recover what had been flooded will have taken place, but also part of the flooded land will have been, so to say, expropriated, because there is a legal custom in these coastal areas. If you are not able to repair the seawalls that have been damaged, you lose your claim to the land. So people who were not able to repair the seawalls they had to repair, in fact, lost their land and had to move. Even if they survived the flood, they had to move from the land to anywhere else, because their claim on land was no longer valid, because they have not been able to repair their dikes.
You say move to anywhere else. That presumably might have included Pembrokeshire, but where would they have gone?
There is a very well documented migration of people from coastal Flanders, including Zeeland and part of what is today Holland also, to other mostly coastal and marshland areas, because this was their environment, this flatlands, this wetlands, this coastal lands. They had to know how to arrange this kind of landscape, how to make them productive, how to reclaim them and use them in a more intensive way. And for that know-how, they were very welcome by bishops, dukes, territorial lords from the north of Germany and Denmark to England and Wales, of course.
You say that they exported their ability to reclaim land, that sort of thing, which obviously made them very valuable immigrants. What else did they take with them?
They might also have taken with them the things that coastal Flanders in particular was famous for in the 11th and 12th century. And then, of course, we think of the know-how of how to breed this large flocks of sheep. Mm-hmm. The sheep which produced the wool, and the wool which made the cloth, which was the base of the big giant Flemish push industrial production of these woolen fabrics, which was really booming in the 11th and 12th century. These woolen textiles were found all over the Mediterranean, well into the Middle East in this period. And the know-how of how to produce the right type of wool but perhaps also the know-how of how to weave and how to dye the right type of fabrics might have been exported to these regions as well.
Thinking of people being forced to leave because of flooding and losing the claim on their land, if we move forward quite a few hundred years, do you worry about the possibility of something like that happening again?
Yes, there is an increasing, in the light of present-day debates on climate change and increasing sea levels, there are increasing worries that these coastal lands, which in this 11th and 12th century have been reclaimed and protected on a permanent way from flooding, well, that they are increasingly getting vulnerable for flooding, because it's a very simple law in the management of a coastal environment. The higher and stronger the seawalls you build, the more vulnerable they are for flood disasters, because the water, which is pressured in between the dikes, has no way, the flood water has no space to accommodate the flood water. So it has to find some way through the dikes and flooding the land. So the catastrophe is triggered by the flood protection system itself. And that's true in the 12th century, and it probably is true today as well.
Might we then see another wave of Flemish emigration?
You cannot abandon areas which are so densely populated for 1,000 years now. That will never be an option. So we'll have to do with coastal rearrangement and coastal realignments on a modest scale, and which, well, we again will build stronger and higher seawalls, even though there always remains a risk of flooding.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Now, one of the questions that's plagued historians and us is how long the Flemings in South Pembrokeshire retained their distinct language and culture. And it seems even the historians at the time can't agree. Now, one, a chap called Ranulf Higden, writing in 1340, said the Flemish language had died out by them, and the Brit, Tuasogion, the Chronicle of the Princes, agrees. But, and there's always a but, a Flemish traveller, Lucas de Heer, begs to disagree. Wille Uytesbrot here at Ghent University knows all about Lucas de Heer. Wille, he went to Pembrokeshire and he wrote about it. Tell me what he said.
He says that in Pembrokeshire, in South Wales, there are still living Flemish descendants, and that he spoke to some of them and they spoke Flemish well. They learned the language from their parents and they handed over from father to son.
But that's a long time for a language to survive, isn't it?
Yes, when that colony was founded early 12th century, and Lucas de Heer went there, it must have been 1570, something like that, yes. Mm. But maybe he was there as a refugee. He fled from his own country and he lived in Britain for more than 10 years. Maybe he was only homesick and longing to hear some Flemish words. Yeah. So maybe actually those people he spoke didn't speak Flemish really well, but he made it like that.
Tell me a little bit about him.
He was a painter, and a painter of Ghent, he calls himself, but he was also a writer, and he was a Protestant, he was Calvinist, and because of his belief, he had to flee from Flanders, and he went to live in Britain. For more than 10 years he stayed there, and he worked there as well. We think he painted there for British nobles, he made paintings, and he also wrote books.
And you've got a book here, what's that?
That is a book with costumes, it's a book with drawings really.
I had a quick look at that earlier, it is gorgeous.
It's a real beauty, that one, yes.
Can we have a quick look?
We have, yes, when we open it, so that's 16th century manuscript De Heer made, and at the beginning he says the title is Théâtre de tous les peuples, a theatre of all the peoples. He wrote it in French actually. Mm. And he's giving, I think, almost 100 watercolours of costumes of people during history and of several nationalities.
And that's an original book?
It's the original, yes, it's the original. He came back to the Netherlands in 1576 after the pacification of Ghent, when things went a bit better for the Protestants, and he must have taken it with him.
And these are beautiful pictures.
They are beautiful costumes. You hear say the Duke of Venice is painted, but as he lived in Britain for such a long time, he also inserted a lot of pictures of people in Britain. No Welsh, I'm afraid. I've been looking for them, but he has here a Scotsman.
So, can you put a monetary value on a book like this?
Oh, no, I would not know.
It's priceless, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's, the Library of Ghent owns it, and we keep it in a vault, secret. No, I don't know.
Did Lucas de Heer also talk about the people in Pembrokeshire? What did he think of them?
He does say something about the English, though, about I tell you about them. No, that's all he says. It's one line about those the language. The British people, well, he says they are much quieter in all their ways than the Flemings or the Dutchmen. And he says when there are lots of Englishmen and women assembled, they don't make as much noise as two Dutchmen.
Wille Oetersprout talking to me in Ghent. Well, now on to Leah and the Family Kund in Vlaanderen. Mark van den Kloot, you're the president of the organisation. Tell me a bit about it. Tell me about what it does.
We are genealogists, so we help people to search their family history.
You've also traced quite a lot of migration as well, haven't you, which is fascinating.
Yes, since a couple of years we are making a DNA project to establish the migration in general of people to people to cover the world, and also to establish a kinship between men.
You know about our project, of course, and about Norman Roach, a man in our village who has this rare haplogroup. Have you found any men with the same markers here in Flanders?
Yes, exactly 11. That represents the E group in total represents 5%, and the rare sub-haplogroup Norman is part of represents only 0.9%.
So Norman is related to these men?
Yes, in fact, they are all descended from one common ancestor somewhere, probably early the first century AD.
Does that mean we can call Norman a Fleming?
I suppose so.
A Fleming way back.
Yes, way, way back. Yeah. Now, it's common, we see in all countries in Western Europe, that the E group is present, and probably that has something to do with the expansion of the Roman Empire.
Because this has been traced back to Egypt, hasn't it? Southern Egypt.
It's northern Africa. That's the main part. But of course, the E group has spread all over Africa also. Part of them left Africa during the Roman Empire period. They were civil Romans. They had the civil right of being Roman, and so I suppose they went with the Romans into Europe as merchants, as military.
And they came to Belgium as well.
Yes, we know that's for sure.
Mark van den Kloot in Leer. Now, this is something completely different. We've come to Ostend, right near the airport, to the Wal Ravesida 1465 Folk Museum, a cluster of buildings where they were and as they were, as the name suggests, in 1465. Now, that's a bit late, of course, for the Flemings who came to Pembrokeshire, but the point is that the original population of this village in the 11th and 12th centuries lived closer to the sea, but had to move back as the tide encroached, a familiar story. Marnix Peters of the Flanders Heritage Agency handled the original archaeological dig here. Marnix, what happened to those people?
As we know from written sources, the village originated probably already in the 13th century, but probably already in the 11th or 12th century, as a kind of a fisherman's hamlet. And due to a lot of problems with the coasts, a lot of storm surges in the late 14th century, early 15th century, they had to move from their prior location, which is now actually on the actual beach, they had to move a few hundred meters inland to the place where you are standing now.
Does any information survive about how this would have been in the 11th, 12th century?
There is some archaeological information on the spot of the actual beach, but it's difficult to get hold of that now because there are 1 or 2 meters sand above on top of it. It's below the high tide, so you can't. It's not easy to get access to it. And in the past, this area has been quite severely eroded by the sea, so we lost a lot of archaeological information. We know that there are archaeological remains from the 11th, 12th century on the beach, a lot of 13th, 14th century. So we know quite a lot about the village in the 13th, 14th centuries. The origin is a little bit more obscure.
The people who lived in this village, would they have been the descendants of the people who had lived closer to the sea earlier on?
I think so, yes, because at a given moment they were obliged to resettle, to relocate their village. So that was the archaeological advantage. They had to build a completely new village in the early 15th century. That's why it's archaeologically more easy to tackle, because it's less complex than a site where people lived for centuries. They only lived here, let's say, about 75 years, because at the end of the 15th century, this area was already left. So that makes it archaeologically a very interesting area.
A snapshot, really, isn't it?
A snapshot, yes, from the 1400s to the 1475s. Yeah.
Is there any information about the lives of those people who would have lived closer to the sea in the 1100s, 1200s? They would have been fishermen, presumably.
Yes, I think so. I think the lifestyle would be, according to me, rather similar to the lifestyle of the people in the 15th century, although we know in the 15th century they lived their heyday. The fisher business was booming in the 15th century. The people were still owner of their own ships. So you see a lot of wealth, in fact, coming in, although we can't describe them as rich people, but they had access to a lot of information. And that, I think, was also the case in former periods as fishermen. Working at sea, they get into contact with other people, they get access to other things which people living inland don't have.
So they would have been comfortably off?
I think so, yes. They had all the things they needed, they had a lot of sources for income, they did piracy. They were also active in the navy. When the Duke of Burgundy needed armed ships, he confiscated ships from the fishing villages, so they had to deliver for the Duke a ship with armed fishermen, so they were in fact also military people. They did piloting services for merchant ships, so they had a lot of sources of income, and they had also access to various kinds of things. So we find in this 15th century village goods from the south, from the Mediterranean, goods from the Baltic, goods from England.
Going right back in time, and I'm thinking here about the invasion of England in 1066, might some of the men from here with their ships, might they have taken part?
That is not excluded. You can't exclude it, because fishermen are also people which are more on the adventurous side of life. They are living at more or less at the edge of the society. They are, as you could describe them, as marginal people, but literally meaning they live at the margin of the land, in fact, between the land and the sea, and they are rather open to adventure. So that might be an indication that indeed there could be a lot of fishermen among the people invading England, because they were adventurous and at the same time they were used to using arms.
Marnix Peters of the Wolravesida 1465 Folk Museum, thank you so much for that. And that's it from us in Flanders. Do join us again next month. Thanks as always to our main backers, the Heritage Lottery Fund, and to you for listening.